doors and alarm systems, which are certainly important. There are also four other topics that Rabbi Kalinsky and I spoke about to discuss either today, at the end, or next week. I'll give you a choice. One of them is taking care of the kitchen, peeling vegetables, things of this nature. One is opening cans and boxes and bags and bottles, which is also food related. One of them is muktzah, and one of them is taking care of someone who's sick on Shabbos. So, any particular preference, any topic grabs anybody here? We have no preference. No preference, okay. So we'll do what we can. I was asked to discuss a particular question. Oh, you have a preference?
Muktzah.
Okay, that's one preference. One person's vote is a person's vote. I mean, Clinton will collate all the votes in the election day. I was asked to discuss in terms of last week's Shia, which actually ties into today's Shia. What, may you ask a non-Jewish person, that was our topic last time, to wash the dishes on Shabbos? A very good question. Excellent question. What's wrong with washing dishes on Shabbos? I mean, I could do it myself. What's the intent of the question? Gentlemen, what's the intent of the question?
Using hot water.
What's wrong with using hot water?
Creating a fire.
The fire's there before you.
You're going to heat up more hot water.
What?
You're going to heat up more hot water.
Excellent. Heat up more hot water. How's that going to work? Because you're pulling out hot water. And the way the hot water comes out, who knows how the system works? Cold water comes in and pushes the hot water out. There's an interesting name for that, presumably. A certain name that we give to a situation where my intention is really to get the hot water out. But without any doubt about it, related to my getting out the hot water, which is in and of itself completely permissible, other cold water is going to inevitably be heated. What's that called?
Secretion.
That's very good. Secretion. Secretion, which is an expression in the Gemara. You're going to cut off the head of the birds so you can have something to play with and the birds are going to die. Are you crazy? So you're going to take out the hot water and other cold waters are going to come in and get heated up. So that's a very big problem. So that's why I am not permitted to put on hot water on Shabbos in my house. And that's true in an apartment house, it's true in a private house, it's not allowed. So the question would be, can I ask a non-Jew to do that for me, to wash the dishes? So the answer is, I believe, yes. It might be, yes, what? We discussed last time that if I can't do something, I can't ask a guy to do something for me. Here's the answer. I never asked a guy to heat up cold water on Shabbos. Didn't ask him that. I asked him to do what? I asked him to wash the dishes. I asked him to put on, in effect, put on the hot water. So, all he's my agent for is putting on the hot water, which is internally, intrinsically, at the government, completely permissible. The fact that, in these circumstances, the hot water is not going to come out of, this, out of the faucet, unless other cold water gets heated up, you know, it's true, but that's not what I asked him to do. So therefore, there's no iser of what we called amira. You're not saying anything which is intrinsically wrong, and there's no iser of shlichus. You're not making him an agent to heat up the cold water. You're making an agent to see that the hot water comes out. Whatever other means take place, it's not a direct agency. That's a simple interpretation of why it would be permissible. And since we're talking about segregation, let's turn straight to the question, which is as follows. There are many situations in which you do something on Shabbos and something is going to happen which is an inevitable byproduct of what you're doing. Give the following example. Many people have alarm systems in their homes, or even in certain shuls. Now, we don't want that if you or your friend walk into the house that the alarm should go off and the policeman should come and be a disaster. So what do? So ideally what should be done is you disconnect the entire system. People don't want to do that. So they disconnect what they call the box. The box is the thing that makes a lot of noise. That's disconnected. Despite that fact, if a person walks in and the box is disconnected, when you walk in there, certain circuits are being completed or broken, as the case may be, and as a result, in certain circumstances, you may even see little LED lights going on or off. You may even hear a little click, click, click when certain circuits are being completed. That click, click, click in different circumstances would send a sign a signal to the box to make a lot of noise. Now you disconnected it, so no noise is made. But something happened, a circuit was completed or broken. May you enter or exit such a house or a shul on Shabbos and Yom? That's the question. What do you say? First of all, by a show of hands, has anybody ever experienced that? That you walk into a house or a shul and you sense that something's going on, either through a LED light or a clicking, or you just know that something's going on? Ever happened to you? So it happens. So may you do it. So now you're trapped. You walk in, you can't walk out. You walk out, you can't walk in. Is that really true? So here's, I believe, is a very important analysis of this question. And let us begin from the beginning. Do you want that noise? Do you care about that noise or those LED lights? Does it make any difference to you? What do you say, yes or no?
No.
There's an expression, which is an important expression to know when you learn the laws of Shabbos, which goes as follows. For the psik resha, with three more words afterwards. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Right. The law nichalei, I don't care about. That makes no difference to me. Nichal, lo yichbas is basically the same thing. I don't care about it, but that makes no difference to me whatsoever. That is a dispute between a man named the Aruch, one of the raped authorities, the Aruch, who said psik resha, lo nichalei is permissible. And Tosa says, no, it's not really permissible. That's dispute number one. Dispute number two is as follows. Is there a problem of psik resha when the entire violation that's going to take place is of a rabbinical nature? What we call midirabon. Shulchan Aruch seems to say in Simen Shin Yud Aleph, beginning, that a psik resha for the rabbanon is permissible. The Brewer says no. So we have two separate and distinct disputes, gentlemen, in the laws of psik resha. Number one, what's the law in a case in which you don't care about it? And number two, what's the law in a case in which the entire violation, if you did it outright, would only be of a rabbinical nature, b'dirabon. Okay? In both of these disputes, our custom is to be strict. The Mishnah Brewer in both. So we should be strict. We should be strict about a psik resha de lo nichale. We should be strict about a psik resha with respect to a derabon. However, at least my reading of the Mishnah Brewer is, if you put the two together, a psik resha de lo nichale with respect to a derabonon, then we can be somewhat lenient. Now, before attempting to apply this ruling to some of our cases, let's try to understand it fundamentally. Otherwise, you don't know how to apply it and what it's based upon. Why should it be, I'm asking you, that if a psik resha de lo nichale is prohibited, and if a psik resha in the derabonon is prohibited, you put the two together, a psik resha de lo nichale with respect to a derabonon, suddenly becomes permissible. We have a general principle that 0 plus 0 equals 0. And over here, at first glance, you have 0 plus 0 equaling 1. Follow me? You have a leniency of psik resha lo nichale, which the Mishnah Brewer rejects. You have a leniency of psik resha by the Rabbanon, which he rejects. You put the two together, somehow it works. It's based on the Tosfos of Sefer Shabbos of Kuf Gimel. But what's the logic behind it? Why should it be so? Let me introduce you. We haven't had this in the first two shirim. A little bit into the world of what we call chakiris. In yeshivas, we learn with chakiris. We have questions. Something semi-philosophical questions. But at the end of the day, we bring them to the real world. Otherwise, they remain philosophy, which we're not discussing. Here's a hakira, a question, a logical issue, which is, why in the world is a psik resha prohibited? The Gemara tells us explicitly, it's brought in the Shulchan Aruch. If I do, we'll use the following words. I do action A. Okay, A for action. I do action A, okay? And what's the result? We'll call the result B. A, I cut off the head of the bird so my kid can play with the baby's head. B, what's the result of it? The bird dies. So if I do A, which inevitably leads to B, then we assume that it's prohibited. The question is, why is it prohibited? I didn't intend to kill the bird. I wanted my kid to have something to play with. So it's a davar she'eino miskaved. I didn't really want it. So why then would you say that the action is prohibited? Let's review again. Davar she'eino miskaved, we assume is permissible. I do action A, which may or may not lead to B. It's permissible. Even if it leads to B, in point of fact, I'm completely guiltless. I didn't do anything wrong. But if A will inevitably lead to B, then action A itself is prohibited. I'm asking you why. After I'm a dava she'eino miskaven, I didn't have kavana for B. I only had kavana for A. B is an inevitable result of A. So what? I didn't have kavana for B. I only had kavana for A. Who wants to try to explain what's happening? Your own words, yes.
It's as if you're doing it yourself because you know for a fact that it's going
to
happen.
So what you're trying to say, tell me if I read you properly. You're trying to say that you're saying that the guy has kavana for A, but not for B. But you're suggesting, since we know, and he knows, that A will clearly lead to result B, so when you have kavana for A, it's as if you have kavana for B. That's what you meant. Very good. Very good. I like that. Let's review again. If you have kavana for A, it's as if you have kavana for B. You had kavana to cut off the head for the baby to have something to play with. It's as if you had kavana to kill the bird. Very good. Very good. Okay? Any alternative suggestion? You like it. I also like it. But it doesn't mean there's no alternative. The alternative is as follows. No. You, the individual, are considered that kavana only for A. However, the halacha steps in. Not in your mind you assume that you know that A leads to B. It's as if you have a kavana for B. No. Your kavana is limited to A. The halacha steps in and says, look, we, the halacha, say that since A and B are indivisible, you cannot have one without the other. So therefore, we're going to view A and B as one action, one indivisible action. And therefore, although it's true that your intention was limited to A, but since the halacha states that A and B are one, so therefore it's a prohibition. With me? A different approach, you understand the difference. So there's a great Goyin of the last century, his name is the Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, or the same called the Kovetz Shiurim, famous Sefer. In the Sefer on Ksubis, he has the following pshat. Whether the Aruch is correct or incorrect should depend upon this fundamental issue. And let me explain to you how. If the way that the Talmidim like, let's review what the Talmidim's pshat. What they say to Talmidim? That I have kavana for action A, but since I know that A leads to B, so we view your kavana for A as if you had kavana for B. Says Rabbi Chanan Wasserman in the Kovetz Shiurim, that would not apply for Slow Nikolay. You can't say that if he did A and he knows that A leads to B, he had kavana for B. He couldn't care less about B. How can you call him a kavana to B? He couldn't care less about it. Okay. Makes a lot of sense. However, listen very carefully, if we assume the second interpretation, namely, it's not what's going on through his head, in his head. Rather, the halacha steps in and says, look, you did A with intention for A. We, the halachists, aware of the fact that A and B are indivisible, are saying, your kavana is only for A. We say that A and B are one. Since A and B are one, your kavana was limited to A. It's true. But the halacha steps in and says A and B are one, and therefore you are in violation. A and B are one. Says Rabbi Chanan, if that's the case, it's of no consequence that the guy doesn't want B. Who cares about B? His kavana is only for A. But once the halacha says that A and B are one, so therefore it's an automatic violation of result B, since he has kavana for A and A only. Because the halacha dictates that A and B are one. So it's irrelevant that he doesn't care about result B. It doesn't make a difference whatsoever. Since it's an inevitable result of what he does, and the halacha puts A and B together, he's in violation. Everyone understand? It's what we call a hakira. It's a hakira. How do you understand a psik resha? Is it the pshat, the Talmidim's pshat, that we consider you to be have kavana for B, even though you only were doing A, but since you know that A leads to B? Or no, your kavana is restricted to A from beginning to the end. You only have kavana for A. The halacha steps in and says that A and B being indivisible are considered to be one unit. The difference will be, says Rabbi Chanan, in a case which has no kavana for B. So according to the first interpretation, it would be permissible. Can't label it as kavana for B because he doesn't want B. And according to the second interpretation, it's going to be prohibited. Why? He wants A. A and B are one. Then he violated the malach. This is what's printed in the Sefer Kovat Shurim Ksuba Simen Yilches. I'll take any question before we proceed. Yes?
Well, I just want to make sure I understand it correctly. Basically, Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman is saying that the case where the A and B are indivisible, that's not called Leinichale. A case of Leinichale will be lenient, but this
No, it's not what he's saying. He's saying it is lo nichale for B. Can't deny the facts, but it's of no consequence because we hit this guy, if you will. Why? Because he had kavana for A. It's enough to hit him. Why? Because A and B are dictated by the halacha to be one unit.
And therefore, it's not really lo nichale, even though
it is lo nichale. It is lo nichale, but it doesn't make a difference. It's lo nichale. It is lo nichale on B. But it's nichale on A. Correct. And since A and B are one, it's treated as nichale. You want to phrase it that way. Fine. Any further questions before we proceed? Yes.
So according to the first interpretation, then why would cutting off the chicken's head not be allowed?
Cutting off the chicken's a good question. Let every situation be a case of lo nichale. He doesn't want the animal to die. The bird to die. It's an excellent question.
Yeah. Huh? Don't get to play with the head.
No, it doesn't matter. Playing with the head is permissible. But the violation is killing the bird. He doesn't want to kill the bird, so it should always be considered. Every case of should be every psikration. Why give the psikration as an example of being something which is prohibited? Should automatically fall into the category of lo nichole. Good question, but since we don't have time to go into all the intricacies, we'll leave it for a moment. Which is a very good question. What I want to say, that's what Rabbi Chana says. I didn't say anything new. What I want to say is as follows. Let me ask you a question. We had an opinion quoted in Shulchan Aruch Shin Yud Aleph that obsecration is permissible with respect to rabbinical violations. Why? The Talmud teaches us in a few places, call the tikkun rabbanon ke'ein d'oraisa tikkun. But when the rabbis introduce prohibitions, they do them patterned after Torah prohibitions. And just as with respect to a Torah prohibition, obsecration is prohibited, it should be prohibited with respect to rabbinical prohibition as well. So why in the world is it in fact permissible to call that one opinion as quoted in Shulchan Aruch Shin Yud Aleph? Why? I don't expect an answer, because I'm just trying to explain with how difficult the question is. It's a very serious question. So, there's a famous explanation to the laws which are the Rabbanan, which is given by fairly recent authorities, we'll call them 20th century authorities, but explaining much earlier Rishonim. The nature of a rabbinical prohibition is fundamentally different from a Torah prohibition. A Torah prohibition is an intrinsic violation. If somebody eats pig, it's an intrinsic violation. And if he ate the pig not realizing it was pig, it was a terrible story. There was a kosher symbol which was supposed to be affixed only to what we call regular beans, was somehow affixed on something called pork and beans. Whoa. With a very prominent kosher symbol on it. It was just a mistake, a terrible mistake. But a mistake. And the guy ate the pork and beans. Gval! There's a kosher symbol. So, yeah. It's not his fault. He didn't do anything. What's he going to do? But he, when he finds out what he did, is required to do tshuva. So it's b'shogeg, it wasn't my fault. But he's left to do tshuva, that's what we assume. However, what will happen if somebody is in violation of a rabbinical prohibition, bishogeg, a rabbinical prohibition, and he didn't know that he had violated it? So there are a number of authorities that maintain, the Nesivis, one of the great giants, and the Meshech Chochma in his Perush on Pashas Shoftim, that no tshuva would be required. Nothing was violated. You know why? Because rabbinical prohibitions are based on a verse. What's the verse? Lo sasur min adava she'agidu lecha. Finish. Yamin and smol. Don't stray left or right. The nature of the violation is rebelling against the rabbis. This fellow didn't even know what he was doing, was not in a state of rebellion at all. Not a purposeful rebellion, not an accidental rebellion. He just didn't know. Therefore, there's no need for him to do tshuva, rule these great Torah giants. So although, to go back to our question, we do have a general principle that the rabbis, when they instituted laws, patterned them after Torah prohibitions. But when it comes to this fundamental definition, what's the nature of the prohibition? By definition, rabbinical prohibitions are different than Torah prohibitions. Rabbinical prohibitions are only rebellions, and the Bishoga, you wouldn't need any tshuva whatsoever according to these authorities. Whereas Torah prohibitions are more intrinsic in nature. You with me so far? Okay. Having said all this, let us now try to analyze why anybody would say that a psik resha is permissible with respect to all rabbinical prohibitions. Shulchan Aruch says that way. Why should that be so? What happened to the principle of kol d'tikun rabbanan k'ein d'oraisa tikun? Very famous principle. Here's the answer. The answer is that according to the Talmidim's pshat, it makes no sense. After all, he had intention for A, it's considered that he had intention for B, so who cares if it's B is by Torah law, P is rabbinical law, should be prohibited no matter what. However, according to the second interpretation, what does that say? That you have intention only for A, but the halacha comes and says that Masa A and Masa B, as I said to you before, action A and action B are indivisible. One can argue that principle is only correct where the nature of the prohibition is action. So if the nature of the prohibition is action, we'll say action A and action B are one. You have intention for A, you don't care about B, it's prohibited anyway. However, if the entire nature of the prohibition is a rebellion is only a direct rebellion. You rebel against the rabbis, it's a violation. This fellow didn't rebel against the rabbis. He's quote, minding his own business. He wants to do something, which is called action A. And then it inevitably leads to B, but which is prohibited by the rabbis. But he wasn't trying to hurt the rabbis. He was trying to just do A, minding his own business. This is the logic for those who maintain, and the Shulchan Aruch among them, that it's a gracious, permissible respect to all laws which are the rabbonim. Now, gentlemen, Yoli Kalinsky provided me with a marker. Okay? Let's analyze what we said before. We'll call it just to make it easy. This stands for psik resha, okay? You know what that means? Psik resha. We suggested two interpretations why psik resha should be prohibited. What was the Talmidim's interpretation? What do you call? You call them a chave, right? Because you wanted A, you knew A that's to B, you were called a Mechavein. Right? Understand? That's one interpretation. Talmidim had a very beautiful interpretation. But I wanted to suggest a second interpretation, that A and B are labeled halakhically as one action. Maaseh Echad. They're halakhically one action. Not that it's considered as if you had Kavanah for B, but it's considered Maaseh Echad. Okay? Now, there are two kinds of levels of halachas, right? What are the two kinds of levels? Minatara. They're prohibitions minatara. And there are prohibitions midirabah. With me so far? Have you got me? Okay. So now, this is one situation. Yeah, I really should redo my chart. This is going to be too cumbersome. This will be too cumbersome. We'll redo it. We'll just take two different I'm not going to go with charts. I don't do them every day. We'll redo it this way. Go back to the old way. This will go back. What did we say before? Min HaTorah and Min Rabbah. Go back here. Here, however, we're going to do it differently. We're going to put it Michalei
nichale, and lo nichale. Okay? So now, the classical case of segregation is this case. This is a disaster, right? Segregation, the nichale, minatora. This is terrible, right? We'll just write down osir just to make it easy. What does it mean? Osir. Aleph stands for osir. Now, what about a psik resha, the lo nichale? So it's a dispute, right? What's the dispute? Some say it's osir, why? And some say it's mutter, why? Mutter is the aruch, why? Because it's not considered, right? This ain't no mechavim. You can't call him a mechavim because it's lo nichale. What does the osir say? Why is it osir? Because it's maaseh echad. This is, comes from where? This also, this is, it's a Kovetz Shiurim says this piece. With me so far? This is how we started. Is this too complicated for you guys? Are you able to follow this? If you can't follow, tell me. I'll just go with it. Who understands what I'm talking about? Okay, good. We'll try to just land and then we'll go off to a different topic. Okay? This is as far as this part of the chart is concerned. We said before, when it comes to a situation with respect to the Rabbanan, there's again a dispute, right? Some say it is usur. Why should it be usur? Why should it be usur? Because they label it as a what? As a mechame. Some say it's mutter. I'm putting it this way, in halachic jargon. It's not the Easter of Maaseh. The Maaseh itself is intrinsically permissible. It's only a violation if you rebel against the Chachamim. It's not considered rebelling against the Chachamim. With me so far? Good. That being the case, what's going to result over here in the bottom left corner? What's it going to be? What's it going to be according to this jargon? Gentlemen, it's a one-letter answer. Mutter. Why will it be mutter? For one of two reasons. Either it's mutter because since it's lo nichale, you're an ena mechave. And, in addition, it's the derabbanan, so eno yisur masen. So we asked the question before, how can it be that 0 plus 0 equals 1? What's the answer? A half and a half equals 1. Because there are two possible violations with respect to segregation. One is because it's considered to be a mechav, that's what Tom Eden suggested. Other one is considered to be one action, because they're indivisible. And each factor knocks out one of the prohibitions. The factor of lo nichle knocks out the mechavim, and the factor of rabbanan knocks out the masa echa, you'll end up it's being permissible. Now, I got used to all this theory, I'm sorry. Let's get back to the guy who wants to walk out of the house, and the system is alarmed. Gewalt! May walk out or may not walk out. What do you say? What do you say? Yeah?
Depends on the history, what's going on with the lights and the...
Correct! So beautiful. It's a psik ratio. Lo nichle, he doesn't care. It's irrelevant. He's not a thief. The noise will not be made. Just some circuitry is putting on some LEDs, it's putting on some click click. Nothing of any consequence whatsoever. So what's the nature of that prohibition? So what do you say about that?
I mean, either it's bona or it's a
Chazon Ish. Oh, there's a gadol here. He knows about the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish says that all electronic circuitry runs a potential Torah violation of bona, soser, you're building circuits, you're destroying circuits. He considers it to be a serious, potentially serious Torah violation. If that's the case, you're stuck in the house, you're stuck, you can't move, you can't go anywhere. However, there's a famous piece in the Tshuva of Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, the great Gadol, who was an expert in this field, and he came to a different conclusion. He doesn't understand why opening or closing a circuit should be considered building or destroying. It's considered to be using. I open it, look at his door, right? Now we're stuck. I open the door, huh? And now I close the door. Like, I consider that over the Sabona, so sir, right? I have a wall. When I opened the door, I broke the wall. Like, closed the door, I made the wall. What do you say about that?
That'd be really chiddush. Can we get out of the house on Shabbos because of the door? Get the alarm. If we climb through an open window, there's a new chumra somewhere. So why don't we say that? That's ridiculous. Because you're not breaking the wall. You're not making the wall. You're using the door. So Rav Auerbach reasons. You're not making and breaking something. You're using it. You're using it. It's not considered making, it's not considered breaking. If that's the case, electricity is presumably something which is prohibited by rabbinic law, not by Torah law. And if it's only rabbinic in nature, we can invoke the rule of sikresha, the lo nichale, with respect to the rabbanans, which is in fact permissible. And that's, I think, is a proper ruling. It's a proper ruling. You may, in fact, therefore, walk in and out of the house, even though the alarm is set. In an ideal world, if it's your own house, when you get married, have your own house, it would be better to completely disconnect the whole system before Shabbos. This way, you walk in and out, nothing's happening. There's no LEDs, and there's no clicks, and nothing happening. Much, much better. But if you can't, you can't. You can't help it. Okay. Yes?
In terms of a psikresha that is nichalei, in your barn, it's a machlokes.
Shulchan Aruch says, mutter, and Mishabru says, us.
So why is it mutter?
Oh, good question. So I wrote it down on top. Eino masa echa. What does that mean?
Eino
isur maisa. Eino isur maisa, right. It's not rabbinical violations are isurim of rebellion. It's not intrinsically violated. It's a rebellion against the Chachamim. Only a direct rebellion is a rebellion. I'm doing A, which leads to B, so I didn't do B, I only did A.
Even though it's good for you.
It doesn't make a difference. I didn't rebel. Chazal said, don't do B. I did A. Let me ask you a very tricky question. Are you allowed to comb your hair on Shabbos? Very tricky question. How to comb your hair on Shabbos? Who knows what it says in the Shulchan Aruch?
Probably not.
How'd you guess? Why not? Why can't? What's wrong with combing your hair? Nothing wrong with combing your hair. Nothing wrong at all. What's the answer? Exactly. It's the secretion. You're going to pull out hairs. You're not going to pull out hairs on Shabbos. Because, you know, they're always loose hairs. You could use a comb. And it pulls the hair out. So there was a man in the Rivosh, Rav Yitzchak Bar Sheshes, a great Godel who lived in Spain, in North Africa, way back when, in the 14th century. So there were those who said, you know what, we're going to comb my hair on Shabbos. Do me something. So, well, on what basis are you doing that? We follow the Aruch. The Aruch is the one who said, if you recall, that segregation below Nichole is permissible. And after all, we don't want the hair to come out. So if you don't want the hair to come out, it's a class of segregation below Nichole. And as a result of that, we're going to do it, and that's all. You should see the response that the Rivosh sent to these guys. He called them all, every name in the book. You guys are bums, and you have a chutzpah, and you don't know anything, and they gave all kinds of names. The question goes, why? They knew the Aruch. Why does the Aruch apply over here? Listen to what the Rivosh answered. It's quoted by the Mishnah Berurah and the Siman Shin Gimel and the Sharatim. He quotes it. This is false. Typical psikresha cases, I do action A in a manner in which it leads to result B. But you know what? There's some way to do A which would not lead to result B. If that's the case, then the Aruch said what he said. And if it's lo nichole, it would be, in fact, permissible. However, if you find a case when it's absolutely impossible to do A, any way in the world, without B, then even the Aruch would agree that it's prohibited. That would answer your question from before. Why, if you cut off the baby's head, is it prohibited according to the Aruch? So the Rivosh explains why. Because it's absolutely impossible to do it any other way. So too over here. It's absolutely impossible to take that comb and comb your hair without some hairs coming out. Impossible. No way. And if there's no way in the world, Even the Aruch agrees that it's prohibited. Now, what's the logic behind this? What's the logic? But the Aruch has a permissive ruling. Here's the answer, gentlemen. The Aruch has a permissive ruling because he rejects this whole idea of what we call Masa Echad. So it's not true. I do A, which inevitably leads to B. It's still considered to be two separate and distinct actions. But only, according to Rivash, because they are separable. True, you did A in a manner which inevitably leads to B. But you could have done A in a different manner, which does not lead to B. So since they're in theory separable, we view them as two separate and distinct actions. However, if there's no way in the world to do A without it resulting in B, even the oracle agreed, according to Rivash, that A and B are indivisible, it's one action, Masa Echad, and hence what's prohibited. So writes the Rivash. That's why you can't comb your hair. Anybody disagree? And say that even if it's really as is completely inevitable, there's no way to distinguish whatsoever, it's still permissible. Whoever disagrees would have to have a problem. What are you going to do with the Pesik Reisha case with the head of with the toy at the plaything? So I'll give you a hint. Could be that the Rambam has a linear view, but I can't go there now. Maybe Rambam would have taken a better view of those who comb their hair on Shabbos. Maybe. But bottom line, you shouldn't do it because the Shulchan Aruch says no. Yes?
Can I ask a question about the Dorot Chazon Ish or something?
Sure.
The Chazon Ish wouldn't say that you can't walk out of a normal door, correct? So I don't understand how Shulchan Zalman doesn't talk about the electricity part at all. He just talks about the regular door.
No, Rav Shulchan Zalman was trying to prove by analogy. Right. Just as you're opening and closing a regular door, it's not called destroying and building, it's called using. So to open and close an electrical circuit, to put on my fan and off my fan, right? I want the fan to go on before I go to sleep and off when I wake up in the morning. So that's considered like I said, opening and closing a door. It's a circuit, it's like a door. That's it. That was his logic.
Would he hold that that's
on a derivative
electricity?
Even if I'm sure you shouldn't put on your fan on Shabbos. What the nature of the prohibition, I'm not exactly sure. Okay, any further questions? Yes?
I was just going to ask, isn't that too good of a proof?
Too good, then it should be completely permissible. Yeah. Yeah? But we won't say that too loud. It's going to be prohibited. It's prohibited on some level, and therefore we don't do it. I was supposed to speak today not only about alarms and the like, which is the Pesik Reisha, because that's what we started at the beginning of this year.
So did you get the logic from the last case?
Of combing the hair?
Yeah.
Yeah, the logic is as follows. The Rivash is even the Aruch. The Aruch holds up Pesik Reisha or Nichole is permissible. Why? Because it's Eina Miskaven, and this whole idea of Maisa Echad he rejects. He rejects Maisa Echad. It's not true. Says Rivash, you know why he rejects it? Because although in this particular case, A and L leads to B, but they are theoretically separable. You could have found a way to do A without leading to result B. Because you could have, it's considered to be two actions. Huh? Now, having said this, the Rivash goes a step further. What is no way in the world to do A without it leading to B? Totally impossible. Even the Aruch would agree, he claims, it's considered to be one action and therefore prohibited by law. That's why prohibits combing your hair. If you look it up, you'll see. Yes?
Is pulling out hair only Mr. Durabun?
That's another good question. What is the nature of the violation of pulling out hair? Let's assume it would even be a what is it, as a matter of fact?
Gozes.
Probably should be gozes. Maybe the rice of this. You take a haircut on Shabbos, the machlokes between, again, the Rivash and Tosfos. Is it what we call in our language a melacha she'ena tzricha legufa? What do you mean melacha she'ena tzricha legufa? Perhaps you don't want the same result that they wanted. In the Mishkan, they shear the sheep for the wool. When you take a haircut, you don't hold on to the hair. So according to some, it's a melacha she'ena tzricha legufa. Some disagree. It's a big dispute in the Ramban, the Rivash. It's a long story. Let me answer your question. I see where you're coming from. He's saying, well, let's say combing hair is permissible. Why? Because even if you'll tell me that the Rivash is correct, what did the Rivash say? That since the two actions are inseparable, therefore, you should view it as one action. But when it comes to the Rabbanan, we don't accept the one action. It's not a violation of one action. What a great question. I love that question. That's a fantastic question. That's a super question. Let me answer you. Okay? Every case of segregation below Nichole, every single one, is also a Malacha Shein Atzricha L'Guf. How do I know? Because when Tosus gets stuck, Tosus rejects the Aruch about Lo Nichole. In all those various cases, Tosus says, well, it's a Malacha Shein Atzricha L'Gufa, which is only a rabbinical prohibition. So the question becomes, my whole theory is intrinsically flawed. Why? Because every case of segregation is lo nichole, is by definition derabbanan, because it's an answer to the gufa. And I said before, if it's derabbanan, it's permissible. So the whole theory can't stand. You didn't realize what a good question you asked. Here's the answer. Gentlemen, when we talk about derabbanan, you have to make a very, 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 very important distinction. Not all derabbanans are created equal. Anyone who learned the Gemara elsewhere, we've shown in Poskim, knows as follows. There are some derabbanan which we call it ikro mederabbanan. The whole thing starts with the derabbanan. And there's some derabbanan which is called ikro midoraisa. It starts off with a din doraisa. And then from some technicality, it's reduced to a derabbanan. Such a technicality would include, for example, melacha shein atzricha l'gufa. So when it comes to ikro doraisa, and it's knocked down to a derabbanan, apparently the nature of those violations are considered violations of action. Since by Torah law, this action is prohibited in certain circumstances, when the rabbis said that although some technicality is missing, and therefore the actual Torah doesn't apply, we still label it as a prohibited action, because it's ikra midaraisa. But if it's ikra midarabbanan, then it's only we started from scratch, you're only rebelling against us. It's not considered a violation of action. That's a very good point that you made. I hope I answered your question. Okay, I know I may have lost some of you, but you'll come back then. I'll tell you what I just said. I hope you understand what I said. Good. So Rabbi Kalinsky will tell you what I said. Okay, fine. Any more questions before I go on to the next... We're supposed to speak about timers. Timers. Not too much time to talk about timers. We used to call them Shabbos clocks. They still call them that? They still call that Shabbos clocks. Let me give you a preliminary statement. According to Rav Moshe Feinstein, all Shabbos clocks are prohibited. Bah. There's almost no one in the world that follows that psak. Everybody uses Shabbos clocks. Even Rav Moshe says, well, they use it for light, well, he can't help it. We assume it's permissible as a general rule. The big problem is, may you adjust the timer? May you adjust the timer? Making the light go on earlier, the light go on later, not go on at all, not go off at all. You know how these things work? Who, by a show of hands, who has a timer in the house? One of those Shabbos clocks in the house. So you all have seen how they work? There's so many different kinds now. And the details are critical over here. There's so many different ways that this can be done. But let's discuss these theoretics. Before we get to some more practical results. If I make something, listen very carefully. I make something happen, but it doesn't happen right away. It happens later on. What is the halachic status of such an action on my part? I'll do something now, but the end result will not happen until later on. Is that permissible? Is it prohibited? At what level? Who knows? Who knows? Delayed reaction. Absolutely, in some cases it's certainly prohibited. I cook, put something into the oven, I put it in now at 12:30, won't cook till 1:30. That's clearly prohibited by Torah law, so there's no question about that. That's the whole nature of cooking. Okay? But putting that aside, other prohibitions. If I do it and it's only going to happen later on, the cooking you can argue is started already right now. It takes an hour to cook. But what if it starts later on? So in certain instances, this is known as a grumma. Give you the classical case in the Talmud. A fire is burning on Shabbos. To take water and douse the fire and put it out, it's not allowed. It's called mechaber. What do I do, says the Gemara? I have 100 barrels filled with water in my house. I take all 100 barrels, put them in a circle around the fire. What's going to happen when the fire spreads and hits the barrels? What's going to happen? It's going to break open the barrels and the water will come and put out the fire. I didn't do it, the fire did it. That's called grumma. Grumma is permissible, at least in cases where you're trying to avoid some loss. This is grumma. So what do you see from this? I encircled the fire at 12:30 with my barrels. The fire won't hit the barrels till 1 o'clock. It's considered to be grumma. I didn't do it. Someone else did it. I didn't do it. The fire did it. You with me? So on this basis, there are some who claim that if I take a Shabbos clock, and right now the Shabbos clock is set to go on at 1 o'clock, and I can't wait that long, so I'll set it for 12:40. So I'll just move it over. So in 10 minutes, it's going to go on. I didn't know anything. Like the same in the case of the guy who encircled his fire with barrels. Is this a good example or is it not a good example? Who has something to say? Who has something to say? Such a bunch of modest people there. No one wants to open their mouth. Humble, modest, private, shy. Which compliments I'm giving everybody. Yes?
I think it's different because putting the barrels around the water is equivalent to setting the timer, like in the first place. But moving it forward would be like maybe pushing the barrels.
He's thinking like a Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Exactly so. In Mincha Shlomo Chasimin Yud Gimel is the following case. I take a barrel and I start rolling it down a hill. It'll take the barrel 10 minutes till it gets to the bottom of the hill, and then it's going to put out the fire. That's called grumma? Maybe not. It's a direct action. It just took a while for the barrel to roll down the hill. So adjusting the Shabbos clock is very likely, it depends on what kind of device you have, along these lines. It's like rolling a barrel down the hill. It started rolling right now. I put a little button in, and the dial is turning. Right now, it starts to move it towards that place where the dial is going to bang into the switch and turn the light on or off. So therefore, it seems to me that one should not rely on any of these leniencies with respect to adjusting timers, because maybe it's not called grumma, maybe it's called an action. My Rebbe of Soloveitchik thought it's considered to be an action, I believe, for this reason. Yes?
But no matter no matter how much time the barrel takes to hit the water, there's an interval between. Whether you lengthen or shorten the distance, the fact of grumma is still there.
No, it's a delayed reaction. Delayed reaction is not necessarily called grumma. The only case in the Talmud that we have, I'll come to an exception, the only case in the Talmud we have by Shabbos, it's considered grumma if I put the barrels around the fire. There is how my Rebbe phrased it. There's no combination of the two things. The fire is moving, and I put my barrels around the fire. They're not working in tandem, they're not working together. But if I take the barrel and I start rolling it, and the force of gravity will work together with me, so then we're working together. The fact that it takes 10 minutes to get to the bottom of the hill, that's an irrelevancy. That's how we explain. There's a problem, though. The Gemara is the case in Shabbos, that same Gemara, it's one other example of grumma. A guy, you know, we complain about people who write on their skin. What kind of funny word, what kind of write on their skin, this and that, it's crazy. What's going on in the whole world today? Crazy. I don't know anything about it, but I just happened to be waiting in an office somewhere, and I saw some picture of some basketball game. And there's a guy, I don't know who he is, maybe everyone's that way these days. They show a picture of a guy in some game, and the guy raises his hands, he's full of tattoos, from here to there. But that's popular now? Crazy people. Crazy. Okay. The guy's not so crazy. He writes something on his skin. With a pen, it's going to come out. It's not going to be tattoo. But the Meshuggah wrote God's name on his skin. Now the question is, you take a shot. You go to the mikvah. Whoa. So the Gemara says that has to do with this, the case of Grama. But the obvious question is, wait a minute. The minute you put water on the ink, on the skin, it starts to what? It starts to, you know, to wash it away. That's the process which starts right now. So how can you therefore suggest that this is called Grama? So if you look on the Shulte Givorim on that daf, he has the following amazing conclusion. He claims that the only time that Grama ever works is with respect to a psik resha. This whole shiur around the revolves around psik resha. What does that mean? I'm not attempting to put out the fire. I'm only attempting to contain the fire. What is it? Burn, baby, burn. I don't care if it burns, as long as it stays within my perimeter of my barrels. The fact that when the barrels are going to break and the water is going to come out and put out the fire, I don't care. That's not my intention. So only with respect, suggests the Shulte Givorim, to a sick ratio, do we say if it's a delayed reaction, it is going to be permissible. And the same thing, of course, is true in the case of the guy taking a shower, going to the mikvah. He doesn't want to erase God's name, he wants to go to the mikvah. So although we don't accept the Shulte Givorim completely, because we accept that even in a case where you wanted to have the fire, you wanted the end result, it's still permissible. That's only in the case comparable to the barracks. You're not joining an action with everybody else. Then we're willing to go against the Shulte Givorim. But a case in which you are working in tandem, you're rolling the barrel down the hill, and you want the fire to go out, that we consider to be prohibited. By the way, the Shulte Givorim is critical. If not for the Shulte Givorim, gentlemen, you are going to be trapped in your house half the year for a different reason. You tell me why. Why will everyone be trapped in his own house every single day? Well, now it's going to get a little bit better. A little bit. Starting next week or next month, it won't happen anymore. I gave it away. What am I talking about? Heat! Who in this room lives in a private house? And does the house have a central heating? You still work with, like in Israel, with small little... Central heating? Everyone has central heating. Is there a thermostat? Everyone has a thermostat. You walk into your house in December, on Shabbos morning from shul, what comes in with you? Not just a malachim. Cold air. A blast of cold air comes in. What happens with all that cold air? It affects the thermostat, and therefore the fire is going to go on in the boiler earlier than otherwise. How do you walk into the house? The answer is the Shulte Givorim. That was not your intention, and it's delayed. Doesn't happen right away. So we have to accept that, otherwise you can't walk into the house. That's why there were some rabbis, without mentioning their names, who said you can't open an oven on Shabbos. So you have food in an oven. You want to open the oven, take out the food, and close the oven again. And the rest of the food you'll take out an hour later. No good. When you open the oven, as a result, what's going to happen? Cold air will come in, and the fire, because the thermostat will go on earlier than before. So I said to that rabbi, I mean, I didn't speak to him, but if I would, I would tell him, how do you learn out of your house in Shabbos? Exactly the same thing. In any event. So we assume that the Grama is limited to cases of delayed reaction with a psik resha, case of the skin in the mikvah, or we go beyond the Shulte Givorim if you're doing action A, and B is working on its own. That's circling the barrels with, circling the fire of the barrels, as opposed to a case of pushing a barrel down the hill. As a result of this analogy, it seems to me one should not be adjusting timers on Shabbos. That's a no-no. If it'll be earlier. If, however, it'll be later, you're not doing anything. You have to be very careful, though, later. Later means forever. It means if you pull the button out, it'll never go on, it'll never go off. I believe that's permissible. Even though some disagree with me in the comments, especially when it'll never go off. But the problem is in these new ones, when you adjust something, so very often, let's say you have the ones that have a dollar, you press the dollar in, you turn it, and you release it. Well, you press a pegging. You have the energy of those things? You turn it, and then you release it. You move it, and you release it. That's no good, in my opinion. Why? When you pressed it in, when would the light go on or off? You kept your finger there till after Abdullah. What would happen? Never. So you move it across, and you let go. So when you're letting go, you are causing it to go on or off earlier than it would have had you kept your finger on it till after Abdullah. The letting go is not allowed. Even though in theory, to make something go on later would be permissible, but you have to check each device separately.
Or to pull out the peg to move it later is off.
If you pull out a peg and leave it out,
but to put it back, it's supposed to go off at 8, so you should pull it out and put it back in at 10.
That's terrible. Because if you left it out, it means you're making it go off at 10, but you would have gone off not at all. So all these cases are really not allowed. So you should be very careful, guys, for adjusting any timers on Shabbos. You just shouldn't do it.
Well, yes. In terms of the lights outside.
Another good question. Situation we're talking about. Can I walk in the streets on Shabbos? What does that mean? There are many people who have security lighting, which means you walk in front of the house, the light goes on. Who has ever experienced this? Everyone does. You ever experienced it on Shabbos, Friday night?
Yeah.
It's terrible. It's terrible. Number one, some of the lights can even be incandescent lights, which are Doraisa. Others are either sodium lights, which are sodium lights, or other abundant, which is gas. It's much better, based on what we said before. And number two, I know I'm sorry to say this to you, but I believe that people enjoy walking in the light. And what happens on Tuesday, you're walking, tonight's Monday. Tonight, you're walking somewhere, and there's some dark street, and the light's going to go on, which enables you to see better. I think people enjoy that. Who disagrees with me? I mean, it's better to walk. It's light, more light outside. We can't afford to light all the streets up like Yankee Stadium. But you know, if it's lighter, it's better. There are no street lights. It's really terrible. Therefore, I view at least some of the cases with it, which is an incandescent bulb, as a psik resha de nichale with an isa min haTorah. The worst of the worst. Aleph. So if you have your next door neighbor, you should offer him to pay him to leave the light on the whole Shabbos. He says, no, I want to catch the guy by surprise. Then you should take the stadium lights. They're dismantling the Yankee Stadium, right? Make him buy the stadium lights. And shine it right there. And make sure to shine it right into the guy's bedroom. The stadium lights. Say, what are you doing to me? I say, what do you mean? Well, I want you. We want light. I want light.
That only works for a neighbor,
right?
What if he's down below?
The Yankee Stadium lights will work for him too. You have to be expensive. Yankee Stadium will cost a lot of electricity. You have to try your best to get the neighbors to do what you want. Otherwise, you're literally trapped in the house. If all four of your neighbors, right, two here and two across the street, you can't move. You're gonna be stuck forever. I have to tell you, Rabbi Eliashiv Shalita has a statement. And something similar to this, which says, listen, it's not called a malach at all. You're just walking in the street, it's not called a malach. That's helpful to us in another case. Gentlemen, whenever you walk out of your house, you're on camera. Are you aware of that? No, I'm not joking around. Satellite, the Googles. Are you aware of that? You're not aware of that? There's a constant satellite focusing on the entire world everywhere. There's no way you can walk in the street without being seen by the camera, and it's recorded on camera. I mean, it's wild in terms of, you know, what potential for the ganav wants to take out your house, out of your home, and they just put that thing on you. They get it to the Google from up there. I'm serious. It's crazy, but it exists. So, bottom line, we assume you're allowed to walk there. Why? Either it's amazing the rabbanon, it's the secretion lo nichle, we don't care about it. Or, according to Rabbi Yoshev, he gives that example, yeah, I'm not doing anything. It's a very big chiddush, you need a big Talmud Chacham to say that. Rabbi Shechter Shlita said it in somewhat different, more limited context, which may apply here as well. Certain malachas, it can work. But I'm out of time. So we have a discussion for next week. We have some of four candidates. Mukta, opening cans, bottles, and the like. Peeling vegetables and the like. And taking care of sick people on Shabbos. You vote with Rabbi Kalinsky, and you tell me by next Monday morning, and I'll, okay? Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay.